Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, September 21st, 2025. First, the news from Science News, the July 2025 issue. In the Department of Health and Medicine, when cities stop adding fluoride to water, teeth suffer. By Alex Viveros. Warren Lepke has been a pediatric dentist in the Canadian city of Calgary for 20 years. Over the last decade, he says, tooth decay in children he's seen has become more common, more aggressive, and more severe. Many of his young patients have so much damage that he has to work with them under general anesthesia. It's always sad seeing a young child in pain, Lepke says. Dental decay is very preventable. It breaks your heart to see these young kids that aren't able to eat. Lepke notes that many factors can contribute to tooth decay in children, including their diet and genetics. Still, he believes part of the problem is linked to a decision made in the halls of local government. In 2011, Calgary stopped adding fluoride to its drinking water. This decision of city councilors was shocking and alarming to dentists, to pediatricians, to anesthesiologists, and others in the healthcare field who knew what it would mean, says Juliette Guichon, a legal and ethics scholar at the University of Calgary, who formed a group that advocated for adding fluoride back to the city's water. Time and again, studies have shown that fluoride is a safe and effective way to prevent tooth decay. It recruits other minerals, such as calcium and phosphate, to strengthen tooth enamel and fend off acid made by bacteria. Oral health can also affect a person's overall health. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that communities add 0.7 milligrams of fluoride for every liter of water. It's up to state and local governments to decide if they want to follow that recommendation. In 2022, the CDC reported that 63% of Americans received fluoridated water. But that practice now is coming under new scrutiny. This year, Utah and Florida became the first states to ban fluoridation. Many local governments are also debating the issue. And Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. directed the CDC to review its recommendation. Adding fluoride to water has been contested in the U.S. since the practice became widespread in the mid-20th century. Opponents have historically voiced health concerns, including about tooth discoloration and disproved worries that fluoridated water could cause bone cancer, as well as arguments that fluoridation amounts to mass medication and violates individual freedoms. More recently, opponents to fluoride in water have cited a controversial systematic review released in 2024 by the National Toxicology Program, which is nested in HHS, Health and Human Services, and evaluates the health effects of substances. That review concluded with moderate confidence that water with more than 1.5 milligrams of fluoride per liter was associated with lower IQ in children. But that dose is more than double the CDC's recommended amount. The review authors couldn't determine if low fluoride concentrations had a negative effect on children's IQ, and merely finding an association does not prove that higher levels of fluoride caused lowered IQ, the NTP notes on its website. What happened in Calgary may be a cautionary tale for other municipalities. Lindsay McLaren, a quantitative social scientist at the University of Calgary, recruited dental hygienists to go to schools and inspect the mouths of second-grade students. Some went to schools in Calgary, and others went to schools in Edmonton, a similar city in the same province that still fluoridated its water. In Calgary, the team surveyed 2,649 second-graders around 7 years after fluoridation ended, meaning they had likely never had fluoride in their drinking water. Of those, 65% had tooth decay. In Edmonton, 55% of surveyed children had tooth decay. Those percentages may seem close, but they mark a statistically significant difference at the population level. Compared to Edmonton kids, Calgary kids were now considerably worse as far as dental health goes, McLaren says. Other variables, including diet and socioeconomic factors, did not explain the differences, she says. In 2024, another study found a higher rate of tooth decay-related treatments for which a child was placed under general anesthesia in Calgary than in Edmonton. From 2018 to 2019, 32 out of every 10,000 children in Calgary were put under general anesthesia to treat tooth decay, compared with 17 for every 10,000 children in Edmonton. The findings didn't surprise local dentists, said Bruce Yahalnitsky, a periodontist in Calgary. This is just obvious to us, but you need to have proper science to prove, in some cases, the obvious. In a similar decision, Juneau, Alaska, stopped adding fluoride to its drinking water in 2007, after a six-member commission reviewed the evidence around fluoridation. A copy of the commission's report obtained from Jennifer Meyer, a public health researcher at the University of Alaska, Anchorage, shows that two commission members opposed to fluoridation made claims about the health effects that Meyer says are false and not grounded in quality investigations. The commission's chair criticized anti-fluoride positions, at one point writing that part of the literature was based on junk science, quote unquote. But he ultimately recommended that the city stop fluoridation, claiming that the evidence about its safety at low concentrations was inconclusive. With the commission's members split at 3-3, the Juneau Assembly voted to end fluoridation. Meyer and colleagues analyzed Medicaid dental records, dental claim records made before and after the city stopped fluoridation. The average number of procedures to treat tooth decay rose in children under age 6, from 1.5 treatments per child in 2003 to 2.5 treatments per child in 2012. The cost of these treatments, when adjusted for inflation, jumped by an average of $303 per child from 2003 to 2012. Those costs end up being paid by taxpayers, Meyer says. When politicians decide to withhold a safe and effective public health intervention like fluoridation, they are imposing a hidden health care tax on everyone in their state or community, she says. More broadly, Meyer adds, ending fluoridation based on weak or misrepresented evidence is not a precaution, it's negligence. Juneau remains without fluoridated water. Calgary, though, voted in 2021 to bring it back. More people voted to reinstate fluoride than voted for the mayor. So that's a success, Meyer says. But in America, we are entering a dark time. Also in the Department of Health and Medicine, a man let snakes bite him 202 times for science, by Megan Rosen. Tim Frieda recalls his worst snake bites in screaming detail. The first was from an Egyptian cobra. The second, an hour later, from a monocled cobra. Both bites occurred at his home in Wisconsin. Both were from highly venomous snakes. Neither bite was an accident. Frieda has now logged 202 deliberate snake bites. It always burns and it's always, always painful, he says. After the back-to-back cobra bites, Frieda had to be airlifted to the hospital and spent 4 days in a coma. Was it a mistake? Yes. Was it stupid? Yes, he says. But he's in it for the science. For nearly 20 years, Frieda, a snake collector and self-taught herpetologist, has self-immunized against venom from some of the world's deadliest snakes. The process involved milking venom from snakes and then injecting tiny, followed by the increasingly larger, doses into his body. Think The Princess Bride, says Jacob Glanville, president and CEO of the biotech company Centivax. In the movie, Wesley built up immunity to the poisonous and fictional iocane powder by gradually exposing himself to it over time. That's essentially what Frieda did, Glanville says. He built up immunity to more than a dozen venomous snakes, including coral snakes, black mambas, and rattlesnakes. Then he'd let snakes bite him. Without that slow buildup, most of those snakes would have killed him, Glanville says. But Frida survived. That's because he's got what may be a one-of-a-kind assortment of antibodies in his bloodstream. These molecules can neutralize the toxins in different venoms, and they may help accidental snake bite victims, too. Glanville, who is working to develop a universal flu vaccine, was interested in other examples where broad immunity might be useful in medicine. Snake bites immediately came to mind. Venomous snake bites kill up to 140,000 people each year, according to the World Health Organization. And more than 600 species of venomous snakes exist. Glanville wanted to create a single antivenom that could target toxins from multiple snakes. He thought Frida could help. Glanville contacted Frida after reading about him in the news. I said, "This might be an awkward question, but I would really like to get some of your blood." Frida responded, "I have been waiting so long for this call." Using a small sample of Frida's blood, Glanville and his colleagues developed an anti-venom cocktail that can quell the effects of certain venoms. A combination of just two of Frida's antibodies plus a toxin-blocking drug called veresplidib completely protected mice from an otherwise lethal dose of venom from 13 different kinds of snakes and partially protected mice from the venom of an additional 6 species, the researchers reported in the journal Cell. The new drug is a big step forward, says Andreas H. Lausten-Kiel, a biotechnologist at the Technical University of Denmark in Kongens Lyngby, who was not involved with the work. But that doesn't mean Glanville's cocktail is ready for prime time. It's an experimental antivenom, Lausten-Kiel says. It's a proof of principle. There are about 10 toxin families that are key targets for antivenoms, says study co-author Peter Kwong, a structural virologist at Columbia University. The new antivenom cocktail targets 3. That's enough to move on to the next phase of testing. The researchers are looking to collaborate with veterinary groups in Australia to treat snake-bit dogs. Frida retired from snake bites and self-administered injections in 2018. Today, he's a healthy 57-year-old who's had regular liver and kidney checkups to ensure that his history of venom exposures hasn't damaged his organs. Tim did something remarkable, and we think it could change medicine, Glanville says. But he emphasizes that no one should be injecting themselves with snake venom. We are actively discouraging anybody from trying it. And from the Department of Physics, How to Generate Electricity from Rain by Jude Coleman. A new way of generating clean power could run your lights with rain. Hydropower typically relies on moving water to create electricity through mechanical energy, such as spinning turbines in a dam. But a new method, described in ACS Central Science, harnesses tiny bursts of energy sparked when rain plunks into a narrow tube. There is a lot of energy in rain, says Xioling Sol, an engineer at the National University of Singapore. If we can tap into this vast amount of energy, we can move toward a more sustainable society. The technique relies on charge separation, in which oppositely charged particles become spatially divided, creating a voltage between them. It's like shuffling across a rug and getting zapped when touching a light switch. Water running through a conductive tube also creates charge separation, but the amount of charge separation is negligible, and in past experiments, the energy produced was outweighed by the power needed to pump water through the system. So wanted a way around that. Instead of using a continuous flow of water, he and his team dripped rain-like drops into a tube 2 millimeters wide. Inside the tube, water driblets flowed with air pockets between them, creating a movement pattern called a plug flow. Plug flows trigger more charges separation than continuous flows, resulting in roughly 100,000 times as much energy. After traveling through the length of the tube, each charged droplet fell into a stainless steel cup. Separate wires connected to the tube and the cup allowed the built-up charge in each to power circuits, creating an electric current. The plug flow from four 32-centimeter-long tubes for 20 seconds produced enough electricity to continuously power 12 LED light bulbs during that time. The method could be scaled up by installing rain-catching tubes on roofs or next to water sources that create spurts of water ideal for plug flow, such as waterfalls. You may wonder what makes orange cats orange. From the Department of Genetics, this article by Mackenzie Prilliman answers that question. Orange cats act so goofy that people joke that the chaotic kitties share one communal brain cell. But most of these domestic felines, along with multicolored calicos and tortoise shells, actually do share something, a single genetic mutation that makes their fur ginger, researchers reported in two studies in the journal Current Biology. Independent teams identified a DNA deletion that causes pigment cells to produce a yellow-red color rather than the default brown-black, solving a mystery that has stumped scientists for decades. Researchers knew the genetic instructions for ginger fur reside in the XX chromosome. Most orange cats are male because they usually have just one X chromosome, which is active in each cell. Because female cats normally have two X chromosomes, both X chromosomes would need to carry the orange trait for a girl to be fully ginger. If just one X contains the trait, her coat would likely become a patchwork of orange and black, because only one X chromosome is turned on in each cell. Most other mammals don't get orange hair based on sex, which hinted that domestic cats carry an unusual mutation. Both research teams identified a deletion near a gene called RGAP36. The deletion boosts production of the protein encoded by RGAP36, but only in pigment cells. There, the protein prevents genes needed to create the brown-black pigment from turning on, leaving the more easily made yellow-red pigment to be produced instead. And looking out from the page is a beautiful ginger cat with the expression, "Well, I knew this already." From the Department of Earth, a Michigan rock takes title of oldest in the U.S. by Evan Howell. A weathered sign in the Minnesota River Valley proudly proclaims, "World's oldest rock." Erected in 1975, it marks a 3.8 billion-year-old gneiss, or so scientists thought. Turns out it's not the world's oldest rock. Since 1999, that title has been held by the estimated 4 billion-year-old Canadian Acasta gneiss, and gneiss is G-N-E-I-S-S. Now, an analysis indicates that it's probably not even the oldest in the United States. Geologist Carol Frost of the University of Wyoming in Laramie and colleagues reported in the journal GSA Today. The age proclaimed on the sign may be overstated by at least 300 million years, the team argues. Instead, the sign should be uprooted, revised to America's oldest rock, and hammered into Michigan's Watersmeet gneiss, estimated to be at least 3.6 million years old. Like many geology debates, this one started as a beer question, says co-author Bob Stern of the University of Texas at Dallas. Extracurricular curiosity led him and PhD student Clinton Crowley to geologists, including Frost, who specialize in dating ancient rocks. When geologists date rocks, they're dating minerals. A rock can be composed of minerals that formed at different ages, Frost says. It's like trying to date a building by analyzing its bricks. For Frost, it's almost metaphysical. So what is the age of the rock? I mean, what does the question really mean? The mineral zircon is a helpful but imperfect record keeper. Its durability, able to withstand weathering, heat, and pressure, means it often outlasts its host rock. After crystallizing in magma, zircons can be swept into sediments or crushed by tectonic forces, processes that form new rocks but may or may not distort the crystal's age. The team sampled gneisses, a type of metamorphic rock, from the primordial heartland of the North American continent in Minnesota, Wyoming, and Michigan. The rock's banded striations and deformed grains hint at a tumultuous history. To calculate the rock's ages, the researchers zapped embedded zircons with lasers and ion beams to measure the steady radioactive decay of uranium to lead. The disputed champion, Minnesota's Morton gneiss, contains zircons dating to 2.6 billion, 3.3 billion, and 3.5 billion years ago. There may have been two rocks of different ages that became mixed at a third youngest time, Frost says. The sign boasting an age of 3.8 billion years? Probably incorrect. Most zircons in Wyoming's Sakowie gneiss date to 3.4 billion years ago, the team found. And then there's Michigan's Watersmeet gneiss. Its zircon ages span a wild 3.8 to 1.3 billion years old, with evidence of a violent past, volcanic intrusion, which is as rude as it sounds, metamorphism, and tectonic upheaval. The team settled on a minimum age of 3.6 billion years, handing Watersmeet the title of America's oldest rock, at least for now. Geologist Mark Harrison of UCLA applauds the efforts, but emphasizes that the results only reflect rocks available at Earth's surface. Frost agrees. The zircons in the Michigan and Wyoming gneisses hint at older rocks that were either recycled in Earth's mantle or remain buried in the crust. I would love to find them, she says. And now we turn to Mark Fischetti's history column, 50, 100, and 150 years ago, in the June 2025 issue of Scientific American. First, 50 years ago, in 1975, slavery by ants is self-destructive. The institution of slavery is not unique to human societies. No fewer than 35 species of ants depend to some extent on slave labor for their existence. The techniques by which they raid other ant colonies to strengthen their labor force rank among the most sophisticated behavior patterns found in the insect world. Most of the slave-making species are so specialized as raiders that they starve to death if deprived of their slaves. Together, they display an evolutionary descent that begins with casual raiding by otherwise free-living colonies, passes through the development of full-blown warrior societies, and ends with such degeneration that the workers can no longer even conduct raids. Summary from 1975 was written by Edward O. Wilson. Also from 1975, tornado outbreak largest on record. During the spring and early summer, tornadoes are likely to occur between the Gulf of Mexico and Lake Ontario. On April 3rd of 1974, conditions were right. The first tornado struck at 1:10 p.m. By 5:20 a.m. the next day, a total of 148 tornadoes had swept across the countryside and cities from Laurel, Mississippi to Windsor, Ontario, killing 315 people and injuring 5,484. In terms of sheer scope and the number of storms, it was the largest tornado outbreak on record. Immediately after, Theodore Fujita of the University of Chicago and his colleagues organized aerial and ground surveys. Fujita and his co-workers found that 74% of the fatalities occurred in houses and buildings, 17% in mobile homes, 6% in automobiles, and 3% among people en route to shelter. Note, In 1971, Theodore Fujita and Alan Pearson introduced the Fujita-Pearson scale to describe tornado intensity from 0, wind speed less than 73 miles per hour, to 5, wind speed 261 to 318 miles per hour. 100 years ago, vacation fun with mud dwellers. The trouble with vacations is that they have a way of being just what their name implies, too vacant. Few human experiences are worse than that of the individual who finds themselves sitting around in the country or at the seashore with 24 hours a day on their hands and nothing interesting to do. Science can help. Anywhere in the out of doors, there is opportunity for real fun with science. In this issue, we describe some of the interesting things you can do and see with rocks and streams and the sides of hills. And we explain some secrets of the clouds. Another good way to make your vacation interesting is to study mud. In the bottoms of sluggish streams and small freshwater ponds, even water-filled ditches along the roadside, there is a vast and interesting world of tiny creatures. Science calls them animalcules, protozoa, protophyta, and other long names. You cannot see them without a microscope, but for the price of one weekend visit to a moderately fashionable resort, you can buy a microscope. You can take it out anywhere and discover this intensely interesting world of the mud dwellers. And from 1875, 150 years ago, two items. First, white ants destroy St. Helena. White ants were introduced into St. Helena Island in the South Atlantic Ocean in 1840 in some timber from a slave ship. Mr. McLaughlin has identified the species Termis tenuis, peculiar to South America. The mischief it has done is almost incredible, and it appears to have gradually destroyed the whole of Jamestown. A considerable portion of the books in the public library, especially theological literature, was devoured by them, and the whole of the interior would be destroyed without the exterior of the volumes seeming otherwise than intact. Note, the insects are known today as Heterotermes tenuis, a subterranean termite. And what about cooking with gas? A gas-burning cooking stove has been invented by B. Giles of Blackheath, England. He claims to have succeeded in cooking the most delicate dishes without their imbibing the slightest flavor from the products of combustion. And those are history tidbits 50, 100, and 150 years ago in the June 2025 issue of Scientific American, compiled by Mark Fischetti. From Mind Matters in the April 2025 issue of Scientific American, why people like expressive faces. Grins and frowns do more than just broadcast emotions. By Ithne Kavanaugh, Jamie Whitehouse, and Bridget Waller. A skilled card player, eyes hidden by dark shades, features kept as still as possible, looks at their hand. Any small giveaway that they're bluffing or holding great cards could lose them a painfully large sum of money. Sometimes it helps to have a poker face. Yet in day-to-day life, when socializing with family, friends, or new acquaintances, for example, you might be better served by letting your features fly free. Our research shows that moving your face in some way, whether you're smiling, raising an eyebrow, or wrinkling your nose, may help people warm to you more. In a study published last year, 2024, we found that people who were more facially expressive were more liked by a new social partner, which could explain why humans have evolved to have such expressive faces. Indeed, our species is probably the most facially expressive. People produce, on average, 101 facial movements per minute in a typical social interaction. To understand why facial expressivity is so beneficial, we first need to emphasize just how crucial social bonding is to human survival. Throughout most of our evolutionary history, our species has relied on tight-knit communities to keep ourselves fed, sheltered, and protected from predators and dangerous outsiders. Managing social relationships was literally a matter of life or death. Otherwise, you might have faced the tiger in the bushes alone. Any skill or behavior that improved someone's ability to create and maintain life-saving bonds was likely to persist in our gene pool and cultural repertoires over the generations, and our research suggests that facial expressivity may fall in this category. In our study, 52 people were filmed in an online social interaction with a researcher who posed as another participant. These dialogues played out over a video platform so people could see one another's faces. Unbeknownst to the real participants, the researcher orchestrated various challenging social scenarios, such as telling an awful joke or demanding 80% of a reward in a negotiation. These situations mimicked everyday experiences, such as social conflict, embarrassment, or an attempt to make a good impression. Throughout, we observed how people's faces moved. We also obtained recordings of more than 1,300 participants in free-flowing conversations with other real participants online. Automated software then coded the small facial muscle movements they made during these interactions. Interestingly, more agreeable, extroverted, or neurotic people, as measured by a questionnaire, were more facially expressive. People with these personality traits may devote more time and energy to social interactions, perhaps because they enjoy socializing or have greater than average concerns about how they come across to others, and that added effort could be worthwhile, we found. After these interactions, the participants and their social partners rated how much they liked each other, as did 176 other participants who viewed video clips of these people. The pattern was clear. People who were more facially expressive were more liked by others. But why would facial expressivity improve someone's ability to build social bonds? Imagine meeting someone new and trying to figure out how good a fit they might be as a friend, a colleague, or a romantic partner. You might wonder whether you can trust them, whether they will help you or harm you, and whether you can even begin to understand each other. Someone who is easier to read may seem to be a more appealing prospect than someone who is more guarded. Our findings support this interpretation. After their social interaction, participants reported their thoughts and feelings at various points throughout the exchange. Later, we compared what those people were thinking with what other participants who saw videos of their conversation read in their face. It turns out that more facially expressive participants were indeed broadcasting what was on their mind through their face. And people viewing these interactions thought the expressive participants appeared easier to read, which strongly related to their likability. Simply put, being facially expressive may give others a sense that they understand you, which they like. This in turn supports the suggestion that the key function of facial expressivity is to make us more predictable. Our work also underscores that facial expressions do far more than just communicate emotions. We might raise our eyebrows to show we're listening intently, share a knowing smile with a friend, or use a stern look to stop someone in their tracks. Sending these kinds of messages doesn't involve any particular emotional state. We also found that likability tracked with expressivity and not with a particular emotion. You might guess, for instance, that people with cheerful expressions are best liked. But although happy expressions were highly likable, expressive people were better liked even when they weren't especially smiley. Furthermore, we found that participants' level of expressivity didn't change across situations or with a different social partner, even as the specific emotions involved shifted. This suggests that facial expressivity is a consistent trait of an individual rather than something that changes depending on the context. That last finding may leave you wondering why some people remain comparatively inexpressive across situations. We want to investigate that question in future research. For some, the costs of revealing oneself may outweigh the benefits, and there could be alternative routes to being an attractive social partner. Clearly, regardless of how expressive we tend to be overall, we can also make choices about sharing more of ourselves in certain situations. Being more open and expressive may be scary, leaving people vulnerable. But our work shows that it comes with rewards. So for now, we think it's best to leave your poker face at the card table. And this column on why people like expressive faces was written by Ms. Kavanoff, a senior lecturer and research fellow at Nottingham Trent University in England, Jamie Whitehouse, a senior lecturer and research fellow at Nottingham, and Bridget Waller, a professor of evolution and social behavior, also at Nottingham Trent University in England. This column appeared in the April 2025 issue of Scientific American. And you are listening to Science Matters on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And next, from the New York Times, posted on October 29th, 2024, written by Amelia Nierenberg, "The World's Doomsday Plant Vault Gets Thousands of New Seeds." A storage facility in Norway, built to safeguard crop diversity, recently received more than 30,000 samples as concerns grow about climate change and food insecurity. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault, in the far reaches of northern Norway, is meant to be humanity's last resort. Imagine it as the world's doomsday garden shed, a secure genetic capsule kept safe in case some catastrophe, a meteor strike or climate disaster, perhaps, threatens the planet's crops. The vault already had about 1.3 million seed samples from about 7,000 species sent from all over the world. Last week, it received about 30,000 new ones. The number itself is notable. It's one of the largest one-time additions since the vault opened in 2008. There are often three deposits a year. But perhaps more significant is the amount of so-called gene banks, organizations that store their own hordes of seeds in locations around the world that participated in the latest donation, said Asmund Asdal, the Norwegian vault's coordinator. It is more important now that many new gene banks in developing parts of the world are depositing valuable and unique genetic material, he wrote in an email. Some, he said, made their first contributions last week. Svalbard is not the only place where seeds are stored, but it is meant to be a vault, a mostly sealed storage place for use in case of emergency. Most of the work of seed saving, studying, and sharing happens in the gene banks. Those banks are a bit like a computer's filing system, in which documents are stored but easily accessible. Svalbard is the external hard drive from where files can be recovered if lost. In recent years, the vault's organizers have extended their scope. They see their work as a race against time, Mr. Asdal said, particularly in reaching out to developing countries or rural communities to protect against the possibility that gene banks could be destroyed by calamities such as severe weather, conflict, or equipment malfunction. As Mike Bollinger, executive director of the Seed Savers Exchange, a nonprofit seed bank in the United States, put it, "If you lose it, it's gone forever." The recruitment push and the size of the latest deposit of the samples reflects the growing stress, the urgency, the need to act in times of climate change, said Stefan Schmitz, executive director of Crop Trust, which operates the Svalbard Vault, alongside the Norwegian government, and NordGen, a genetic research center. This time, 23 gene banks made contributions, one of the largest groups to do so in a single window since 2020. There are more than 1,750 gene banks around the world, according to Crop Trust. These deposits reflect a widespread awareness that the climate in which humans have thrived for the past 10,000 years is now gone. Laurie Parsons, an academic at Royal Holloway, University of London, who studies climate change, wrote in an email. Inside the Svalbard vault in 2018, boxes contain seeds from all over the world. The latest donation is one of the largest one-time additions since the vault opened in 2008. The end of the world, at least as humans know it, may not come from a single disaster. Gene banks also guard against the possibility of a gradual demise, and seeds, like eggs, are safer in several baskets. Among the threats, the climate crisis looms large. In 2023, the hottest year on record, around 2.3 billion people faced moderate or severe food insecurity, according to the World Health Organization. Researchers have also found that more than a third of the world's tree species are threatened with extinction. Many of the vault's new seeds come from areas suffering from disastrous floods or raging heat waves, which makes crop production harder. More immediate threats come from human conflict. Fighting has displaced farmers, and bombs have obliterated crops. The first withdrawal from the Svalbard vault happened in 2015, after serious civil war devastated a seed bank near Aleppo. Recovery samples were shipped to stores in Lebanon and Morocco. This year, some seeds have arrived from the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories. More will arrive early next year from Sudan, which has been pummeled by hunger and civil war. There are other concerns. Seeds do not keep forever. Genetically modified crops often used in industrial-scale agriculture have edged out older varieties. That can leave local chefs and gardeners who grow and use traditional seeds as important cogs in the machinery of preserving diversity. Dr. Schmitz said he thought that the future of climate-resilient agriculture might rest on seeds that farmers have overlooked for decades. The 1,145 deposits from Chad, for instance, have adapted to withstand a harsh climate. They could be useful to researchers trying to grow crops resistant to heat and irregular rainfall. Mankind forgot, a little bit, the richness, the wealth of what we have, Dr. Schmitz said. Svalbard, an archipelago that is also home to other records of humanity, such as the Arctic Web Archive, a major data storage center, is key to the preservation. But the Arctic is changing. Last year, temperatures there were rising four times as fast as in other parts of the world. Melting permafrost led to a small flood at the vault's entrance in 2016. Those issues have since been fixed, Dr. Schmitz said, and the flood water pooled far from the seed stores. Despite the rising temperatures, the seeds should be safe in Svalbard's vault, which stays well below freezing point even without electricity, Dr. Schmitz noted. Nothing, he acknowledged, was 100% sure, but he added, I would say that it is the safest place of all you could find on Earth for such an endeavor. And the author of this article, Amelia Nierenberg, is a breaking news reporter for The Times in London, covering international news. And now we turn to the September 2024 issue of Scientific American, where commentary on science in the news from the experts in Forum poses, climate change is changing astronomy. Astronomy's future may be slipping away, one climate disaster at a time, by Sevan Rasmussen. You're evacuating, right? I tapped out on my phone in September 2022. Hurricane Ian was bearing down on Fort Myers, Florida. My father, a Florida native and seasoned shelter-in-place hurricane survivor, texted me his grab-and-go list as he fled his home there. Important paperwork, the dog, two outfits. I'm not taking any chances with this one, he said. Days later, when the debris was finally cleared from the roads, we learned just how devastating this one had been. The roof of his concrete riverside bungalow was still there. Two walls held it up. Everything inside the house was gone, and every house on the block had been swept through. I was 6 months into my second astronomy postdoc then, the culmination of more than a decade of work. I had overcome the odds, summited the mountain of academia to gain a place at the forefront of exoplanet science. We had celebrated my success on my last trip to my father's house, as the golden trail of a Cape Canaveral rocket ripped a seam through the darkening skies. But even then, I had begun to wonder if my place among the stars meant that I was too far from Earth. Those of us born after 1977 have never seen a cooler than average year. Since then, the frequency of major hurricanes has doubled, and the incidence of wildfires in northern and central California has quintupled. My generation, those who grew up with the now silenced clamor of insects, and memories of snow days that don't seem to come around as often anymore, is neither the first nor the last to sound the alarm on our rapidly changing planet. The sirens have been wailing for decades. You might think, as a scientist, I'd be especially attuned to the facts and figures and the dire future they portend. But after a while, the sirens fade into the background and the numbers start to run together. When I think of climate change, I do not think about the data. I think about the shoebox full of things my father found on the lawn. Two tuba mouthpieces, a waterlogged photograph of me at 11, a $2 bill in a Ziploc bag. I think about the big coat I bought when I moved to Indiana for graduate work that I never wore after my first year because every winter was warmer than the last. I think about the portable air conditioning unit I had to buy when I moved to Tacoma, Washington, a city that wasn't built to endure sweltering summers. Most of all, I think about those to come after me. Before Hurricane Ian, I had never questioned whether I was doing good in the world. Of course, I was contributing as an astronomer. It felt noble, studying what we can never touch or use, science simply for the sake of curiosity. But afterward, I had to ask myself whether it was enough. I could no longer shake the feeling that I was so occupied by other planets that I couldn't see the problems on mine. As astronomers quietly ask themselves about the value of our federally funded science in a disastrous warming world, we must face the reality that the nation's highest halls of power will echo with those questions as well. Just this year, Beltway policymakers sought cuts to both the Chandra X-ray Observatory and the Hubble Space Telescope, ones so severe that they would all but shutter the former. Such cuts are a product, in part, of growing pressures already constraining the budgets of NASA, the National Science Foundation, and other major public sources of funding for space science. We must then consider the fate of our multi-billion-dollar journeys into the solar system in a world increasingly subject to multi-billion-dollar disasters. Although the projected spending peak has already passed for NASA's latest orbital eye to the sky, the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which is set to launch in 2027, the space agency has even grander plans on the horizon. They include the Artemis program, which costs more than $7 billion annually, as well as an effort to retrieve rock samples from Mars that is currently undergoing a back-to-the-drawing-board replan after being deemed too expensive. But the project that many astronomers are most excited about is NASA's next great space telescope, the Habitable Worlds Observatory, or HWO, slated to launch in the early 2040s after a multi-decadal development at a projected cost of some $11 billion. Here's the problem. By the 2040s, the world as we know it now will no longer exist. And with those multi-billion dollar crises on the rise, being just one category from climate change's myriad possibilities for fiscal ruin, funding for fixes must come from somewhere. In the 1980s, natural disasters that cost more than $1 billion, inflation adjusted, occurred at an average rate of 3.1 per year, with 297 annual deaths compared with 17.8 events per year in 2017 to 2021, with 911 annual deaths. Might Roman be NASA's final foray into ambitious orbital observatories? Will HWO make it unscathed to its notional launch pad later this century? The cost for each of the space missions so many of us love is comparable to that of a single climate disaster, a single recovery from an event that now can occur more than 20 times a year. As such calamities become commonplace, space science might begin to look like a luxury we can no longer afford. Staving off climate change's worst effects falls most immediately on the national governments and multinational corporations, fossil fuel companies chief among them, that collectively brought us to this impasse. But after decades of top-down failures, we must take matters into our own hands to push our warming world and ourselves onto a better trajectory from the bottom up. Today, for better or worse, my father's house has been rebuilt just as it was, 20 feet from the water, awaiting the next once-in-a-century storm. But I have uprooted myself. I left my second postdoc, gave away my textbooks, parceled out my in-progress research, closed out my tag-clogged web browser for the last time, and traded it all in for an adjunct professorship. Now I spend my days teaching whoever walks into my classroom about not just the stars above, but how they are connected to the earth below. Astronomy is a joy, a miraculous expression of a universe seeking to know itself. I want to see new astronauts on the moon. I want to learn whether Mars once had life. I want to know whether we are not alone in the galaxy. All this and much more is possible, but the prospects diminish as our global ecosystem degrades. For every step we take to defend that joy, we must take another to defend our climate. Each of us should pause to think about what that looks like for ourselves and our communities. But not for too long. We can leave a better future for those to come only by acting now. The author of this article, Zevin Rasmussen, is a professor at Tacoma Community College, where she teaches physics, astronomy, and astrobiology. She is author of the forthcoming book, Life in Seven Numbers, A Journey into Astrobiology and the Drake Equation, which will be published by Princeton University Press in 2025. This article, Climate Change is Changing Astronomy, appears in Forum, a commentary on science in the news from the experts. It was published in the September 2024 issue of Scientific American. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for joining me today, and please join me again next Sunday.